This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
John Morris on Twitter saying, Dr. K's not wearing a black tie and full suit. Is everything all right?
Yeah, no, it's just simply because of the... Because it's the last time I was in a festival, it was incredibly muddy, and I just thought that a suit probably would be the one thing not to be wearing. But you're not either. You're wearing a T-shirt which says the Born Again Floozies.
Born Again Floozies, who were a band who played on the programme when we did the show from Indianapolis.
Were they good?
Honestly?
Yes.
They were rubbish. But I liked the T-shirt.
Okay.
So that's why it comes out all
right.
the time. Matt Sears says, worryingly, you were wearing that T-shirt yesterday.
No, I wasn't. Actually, I was wearing a T-shirt that's exactly the same hue as this, but the T-shirt I was wearing yesterday was for the Hot Club of Cowtown, who are a great Western swing band who I like very much. This is an Indian Runner T-shirt.
Mark in Port Talbot. Mark's comments on the invasions of England and the invasions of England show that while he may be an expert on film, he's not on history. England was never invaded by the Romans. There was no England in AD 43 and no English. However, England was invaded by the Normans, not the French, in 1066, nearly 1,000 years ago. The point that Ralph McTell was making was that modern England has not been ruled or subjugated by another country in the same way that Ireland, Scotland and Wales have been dominated by England up until quite recently.
Okay.
All right.
I stand duly corrected.
And Peter Smith, who's our friend in Prague. Simon and Mark, greetings once more from sunny Prague. I'm still flushed with joy after the confirmation last week that Ridley Scott will return to the Alien franchise to direct a prequel. I distinctly remember Sir Ridley on your show lamenting the fate of his baby, particularly the mawkish tosh that was Alien Resurrection and the hybrid nonsense of the Alien versus Predator films. This is the best news ever for Alien fans, a complete reboot, with the studios having the sense to get in the director of the original and best, probably the most impressive sci-fi horror film of all time. Just wanted your thoughts about it. That's all. Best wishes, Peter.
Well, yes. I mean, my only feeling about it is, do we need any more Alien films? At all.
Well, a prequel might do.
Well, okay.
How did the beast get to be on that planet in the first place?
Yes,
where did Sigourney get that vest from?
No, but there's... Well, we already know that, actually. Because, of course... Oh, no, well, hold on. In Aliens, in the director's cut of Aliens, there's all the stuff about Sigourney Weaver's life on Earth before she went off on the first Alien mission, which is how we discover that she had a daughter who was the same age as Newt is in Aliens... at the point which she meets Newt. So we've had some prequel stuff already. I mean, I just think, anything Ridley Scott does will always be of interest to me. I honestly don't know whether I want to see another Alien film ever again.
Well, that's that done, then.
No, but, I mean, don't you feel sometimes that things are, you know...
If it's him doing it and it's a prequel, maybe he can, as Peter says, reboot the whole thing in the same way that they've done that with Star Trek.
Yes, that is possible.
Maybe that's...
Can I, before I forget to do it, because somebody passed me, I need to say hello to Sam Lawton, who is a very keen listener, and that's very nice, and he's just recovered from an operation, and he's just discovered Local Hero. So hello to Sam. Can you say hello to Sam?
Yes, we can say hello to Sam. Ewan Pearson. Simon, I went to Cropperty as a youth with my family. The only thing that matters is that you see the godlike genius Richard Thompson. But then you know that. Who's playing tonight?
Yes, with his reign.
Dave in London. Dear Wes and Ursun, which I haven't quite got. I was in the DVD place the other day looking for a film to rent. I picked up Gran Torino, which I know the good doctor very much liked.
Yeah.
As did a lot of other people. But the good doctor is also a bad doctor because he told us what happens in the end.
No,
so
I didn't.
So I put it back on
the shelf.
No,
I didn't.
I put it back on the shelf.
I absolutely did not.
I put it back on the shelf and got out Benjamin Button instead, which was a miserable pile of poo.
Yeah, let me be very clear. I did not say what happens in the end of Gran
Torino. I think it sort of came out.
It didn't. I never said what happens in the end of Gran Torino. Honestly, I'm... You know, you hear the sound my voice is making now? This is genuinely offended. I did not give away the end of Gran Torino.
As if you would have any spoilers... Ever.
No, you're the person who says, you know, look out for Dumbledore.
Well,
things aren't going to work out well for him in this movie.
It might have been okay. I think we've been a bit more vague
since
that moment.
He's a girl, it's a sledge, she's a ghost, whatever it is.
Dear Lauren Greenstreet, says Tim.
I really didn't give away the end of Gran Torino. I can't tell you how stung I am by that.
You did. I hope that there'll be more discussion of Mesrine Killer Instinct.
Mesrine.
When the second part of the film is out later this month, I liked the film a lot and wasn't even put off by Mesrine looking like Boise from Only Fools and Horses and the Green Green Grass.
No, it's a fantastic... I mean, part one is really, really good. I heard Andrew liked it as well, which is very good. It's a really terrific piece of work, and it's one of those rare cases in which I think what's really great about the film is down to the actor rather than the director. I think Vincent Cassel is just a terrific screen presence, and he really holds that film together. And part two is coming up, and yes, we will revisit part one and part two. A couple of people have said, why haven't they been shown together in cinemas? I think some cinemas showed Shay parts one and two together, and certainly when we saw that in Cannes, we saw it as a six-hour epic. But actually, I think there's something quite nice about splitting up the parts of Marine because it, you know, they are two very different sides of a story.
So what we have is a couple of minutes away from the news.
Yes.
So why don't we start the box office top 10? We'll see where we get to in the 10.
And bear in mind, because I've been off for 2 weeks, there is a load of stuff which I haven't seen. So we can take during the news if people want to text in their own reviews of the stuff which I haven't seen.
85058, it's mayo@bbc.co.uk. I'll direct the wasp towards Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you. At number 10, Coco Before Chanel.
Yeah, which is the new film by Audrey Tautou, and I haven't seen it.
Number 9, The Hangover.
Which I have seen and I wish I hadn't.
We could get some of our children to protect us from various bugs, actually, couldn't we, if they come in?
Should we smear them in jam and get them to run around so they get stung instead?
Number 8 is Orphan.
Which I haven't seen, but I've read some interesting pieces about.
Ice Age, Dawn of the Dinosaurs, at number 7.
Yeah, which I have seen. The death of narrative cinema was, you know, accomplished in parts 1 and 2. And we're getting a cheering over here.
There's a small boy, age 9,
coming.
What did you make of Ice Age, Dawn of the Dinosaurs?
It was amazing, and I understood it even though it was my first ever Ice Age film.
Did you not think, Joe, that the story was a little bit all over the shop?
No, not really.
There you go. So my 9-year-old son corrects you on
air. All right, hold on 1 second. What? Gabriel, Ice Age, any good or not? Ice Age, Dawn of the Dinosaurs, say it was rubbish. Say it was rubbish.
It was rubbish.
Thank you. Go.
I've never seen it.
Okay, go.
Right, what we had then, I'd just like to point out, is my son Joe giving an honest review, and your son Gabriel being forced to tell a lie.
No, it was honest.
It was a lie.
It was honest.
Gabriel, come around this way.
I haven't seen it.
Gabriel, come around this way. Okay, we're giving you your own microphone. This is Gabriel.
This is really not sensible.
Son of Mark. So what did you really... So you haven't seen that film that Mark made you talk about?
No, I haven't seen Ice Age 3.
But you'd like... Would you like to see it?
Yes.
No.
This is the future,
yes.
Isn't it? This is Mayo and Como Junior.
Can we move on with the top 10?
Should we move on now?
Okay.
Okay, right. This is a very, very unwise thing, isn't it, to put the children on? Right, take the microphones away from them. Very good. So, where are we? Orphan at number 8. No, we've done that. Taking of Pelham, 123
at 6. You know, it's basically the same film as the original, but louder, shoutier, shootier, swearier, with more explosions and stop laughing Mayo.
I just thought it was funny. The Proposal at 5.
You know, Sandra Bullock has done better work in the past. I'm sure she won't do better work in the future. Gee. It's very hard liking Sandra Bullock.
Yeah, we need to think of things for Sandra Bullock to do.
Because she really would look forward to getting a proposal for a film from us.
No, but she would be good. She should be good.
She should be good, yeah. She should be good, but she isn't.
G-Force is at 4.
Which is, you know, it's fun. It's kind of animated fun, and it's, you know, but it's nothing great, but it's perfectly good fun.
Yeah. The kids want to come back on air, but they're not going to. Harry Potter, Half-Blood Prince at 3.
The unhappy event, which was blown here on the show by you, still holds some kind of dramatic force, clearly. I really like it. I think it's the second best film since Azkaban.
This on Twitter.
Yeah.
You can go to twitter.com. Wittertainment is the thing that you follow.
Yes.
And you get various sort of nonsense through the week. Will Chadwick says, I can assure the good doctor he never spoilt the ending of Gran Torino. That would have been Dr. Andrew Collins.
Thank you very much. Thank you. No, seriously. I mean, there are many things I'm guilty of, but that wasn't one of them.
Just completing the top 10, number 2, G.I. Joe, The Rise of the Cobra.
And came out when I was away and, more importantly, wasn't shown to the press anyway. So this is entirely a case in which the producer said, oh, well, we don't want reviews. We just want, we want the audience to tell us. So you, the audience, if you have gone to see G.I. Joe, when I was off on holiday, as I said, I went to see G-Force, write in and let us know. I mean, I hear that it's not terrible.
And the UK's number 1 is The Ugly Truth.
Again, off. Have to catch it up this week.
You will have to, and you'll have to pay money.
No, but I think what I'll have to do is pay money to go and see G.I. Joe.
So if you've seen any of the movies and you can fill in the blanks, mayo@bbc.co.uk.
Particularly with G.I. Joe, just because, on principle, because it's one of those ones that they didn't, you know, there weren't press screenings, blah, 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 blah. So.
Just to explain the various noises, apart from Mark and myself, it is very windy in our plastic tent.
It is.
That's causing a lot of noise. Also, the sound drifting over from the stage here at Cropperty will be Scott Matthews. who finishes in about 20 minutes' time. Then it's Aid Edmondson.
Aid Edmondson making a very big folk punk racket.
Exactly.
Okay.
Just before the first review, Dear Hicks and Goat Boy, taking several pieces of the good doctor's advice,
yeah.
I hastened along to catch the early showing of Sam Raimi's superb shocker Drag Me to Hell, now finally released here in Dubai. A brilliantly effective little film, skip loads of atmosphere, a sly sense of humour, and a director who's not afraid to throw his cast vigorously around the set.
Yes.
It was one of the best horrors I've seen for years.
Good.
With more than a few moments where the popcorn nearly hit the ceiling.
Good. It is a real good, you know, jump and spill your popcorn movie. Which
what made it especially great was that I managed to sit slightly more than the, I had slightly more than the prescribed one seat free to the front, rear, left and right.
Oh, brilliant.
As the good doctor prescribes. In fact, a mere 466 seats were available, as I was the only one in there.
No!
Slightly saddened that such a well-done film should get so few people in the door, I was very heartened that it wasn't obviously cut. A common problem in this region.
The only irony of that is that of all the films that it's quite worth seeing with an audience, Drag Me to Hell would be the one, because it's much as I don't like having people around, there is something about seeing a good sort of, you know, boogaboo frightener in which people do go... next to you, which is quite exciting.
Sam in Kent, just some thoughts on the films Mark hasn't seen to fill in the blanks.
Yeah,
Coco Before Chanel, My Mum Will Like It, It's Very Nice, but to be fair, Audrey Tautou is very good in it. Orphan, quite silly and falls apart in the last 20 minutes, but very well acted, especially by the little girl, and very creepy.
Thank you.
For an hour in the middle.
Excellent.
The Ugly Truth, I'm guessing he hasn't seen this since it came out last week. Vile. Two hateful, stupid people at the centre of a rom-com with precisely... no laughs at all. I'd complain about its misogyny, but it hates everyone, not just women.
Who's that from?
Sam Inglis in Kent.
Can you get him to Depp next time?
No, there is no Depp possible.
Okay, good.
Okay. So what's new that might be intriguing us to
the Time Traveller's Wife, an adaptation of a famous novel by...
Audrey Niff...
No, come on.
Audrey Niffenegger.
Audrey Niffenegger. And she wrote it. So, anyway, apparently, did you read the novel when it came out?
I did not.
Okay, the novel was apparently widely acclaimed and widely read, although I have to confess that I haven't read it. I assume that maybe you had, but in that case, we shall proceed that neither of us have read the novel. Story is, a man has the ability to time travel.
Is he married?
Well, not yet.
Ah.
Well, actually, there's an interesting conundrum. Funnily enough, in a flippant aside, you have cut right to the very heart of the review, which was I had actually planned for about 5 minutes later.
I spoiled it?
You've gone straight to the heart of the,
periphery,
of the issue, straight to the heart
that.
Of the periphery. Okay, so is he married yet? Well, one of the things about time travel is, if time travel exists, of course it exists in all times, because people move from one time zone to another, and then there is no such thing as linear time. So the thing is, he is leading his life in a linear fashion, but like Billy Pilgrim, the hero of Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, he has come unstuck in time, and at completely unforeseen moments, he disappears from the present and moves in time and turns up in another place in time, always turns up naked, much in the way that... you know, like the beginning of Terminator, when you go back through the time thing, you can't bring your clothes with you. And actually, I quite like that detail. So the very first thing he has to do wherever he arrives is find clothes, because the clothes don't time travel with you. Okay? Fine. So it appeared at the beginning of the film that he was only travelling back in time. He wasn't travelling forward, which would explain why it is that when he turns up in a library and Rachel McAdams comes up to him and says, "You don't know me, but I know you," he doesn't know her, because apparently he hasn't been forward in time and met her yet. Anyway, here's a clip.
Can I help you?
Henry. It's you. You told me this would happen. And I'm supposed to act normal, but I'm not really acting very normal.
I'm sorry. I really have no idea who you are.
Look, I know how odd this must be for you. It's odd for me. But, would you like to have dinner with me? And I'll explain. Henry, we've been planning this dinner for a long time.
We have?
So, is it yes, then, to dinner?
Okay.
Now, what she then explains to him is that at some point in his future, he time travels back to her past and he meets her as a girl, as a young girl. And they start having a friendship. And the friendship is clearly going to develop into something more, which is that they are then going to meet each other at the point when they're both grown up. and they're going to get married. Although, in actually a very lovely moment, as he's going to get married, he time travels and so disappears. And then him from the future time travels back to his marriage. So she actually marries him at an older age, which is in fact the age that he was at when she first met him. Now,
I can do with a beer at this
fine,
point.
Fine, exactly. So the number of issues to be raised. The first one is, whenever you get into this sort of time travelling thing, you can do one of two things. You can either do the whole time travelling conundrum, you know, the butterfly effect. If I do this, will I meet myself? Will I become my own grandfather? Or you can do what it says in Austin Powers, which is when Austin Powers says, won't I meet my own grandfather and become myself? And Basil Exposition says, I suggest you just don't worry about that, Austin. And then he turns to the audience and says, and I suggest you don't worry about it either. And there is definitely an Austin Powers part of Time Traveller's Wife, which is saying, look, really, don't think about this too hard. The problem is, it's very hard not to think about it too hard, because although essentially it's not a movie about time travel, it's a movie about, you know, life and love and relationships and memory more than anything, it does keep having special effects sequences in which people disappear from one moment and turn up in another moment that cause you to do that Star Trek, hang on a minute, fella, and that is a problem. There is also a problem that it appears from halfway through the film that he's actually able to travel forward in time, at which case the whole narrative falls apart, because if he can travel forward in time, how come he didn't know her when he got to the library? Okay, fine. So those are my problems. On the plus side, and there are many plus points, it stars Eric Bana, who I like. I mean, some of his work is not as great as it ought to be, but I think he's always a watchable screen presence. It's written by Bruce Joel Rubin, who you remember was the screenplay writer of Ghost and Jacob's Ladder. Remember there was that time that Jacob's Ladder was famously hailed by, I think it was Variety, as the great one of the greatest unmade screenplays of all time, and then it was made into Jacob's Ladder, and actually it wasn't a particularly huge hit, although I think it was quite an interesting movie. And at its centre, this story about two people who are meeting at the wrong times in their life, and there is one kind of moment when they come together at the right age, at the right time, obviously alludes, albeit not deliberately, to Benjamin Button. And I hated Benjamin Button because it was so boring and ponderous and full of itself. And the thing about Time Traveller's Wife is it isn't any of those things. So it's better than Benjamin Button. It's got a bit of Austin Powers in it. It's written by somebody who has form in this area. And despite the fact that there are several things wrong with it, if you actually sit down and try and figure out the plot, which I'm not sure whether those problems exist in the book, but I suspect that when you read the book is written in a way which means that you don't sit and worry about the plot problems. You just think, okay, that's not important. We're not in Doctor Who territory. We're not in Star Trek territory. We're not in time-travelling territory. What we're really in is emotional truth territory. The problem is, when you turn that into a film, you do end up doing the H.G. Wells, hang about a minute, why isn't that there, and how? Why isn't that there, and why don't all these things quite fit together? But even with those problems, and even understanding that it's a film which is not going to do particularly well at the box office, I don't think. I think it's been a problematic release. I think that there are enough things about it that demonstrate they were having a good, solid bash at it. And you know what? There were two moments in it in which I was very genuinely quite moved. And there's a moment, and this is an interesting case about, you know, not giving away the end. It being a time-travelling movie, the end is revealed in the middle. Okay, because we see the end at the middle, because it's a time, you know, he travels forward,
right,
and he sees his own moment of death in the very much the same way as 12 Monkeys begins with Bruce Willis seeing his death through the eyes of a child. And there is an echo of that in Time Traveller's Wife. And even though I think that 12 Monkeys is a completely, you know, wonderful, pristine text and one should never, ever invoke it, I thought they got away with doing so here. So generally, despite the flaws, despite the fact the very first thing you said was absolutely the, okay, and that's why the film doesn't work, and that's why the film is never going to work properly.
I only asked if he was married.
No. Yeah, but you did it in a way that you meant so much more.
I know.
Or maybe you didn't. Maybe you just meant that. And
a query from Martin in the US.
I liked it.
You did?
Yes, but I did.
Martin in the US, why isn't it spelt right?
Oh, because it's American. I know, Time Travellers with only one L.
It's got one L.
Yeah, I know. It's like Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Because when words
are spelled... Or Pearl Harbor.
Or even Inglorious.
Inglorious.
When words are just spelt wrong, it doesn't feel right.
No, but I suspect it must be that in America you write Travellers with only one L, which of course is foolish, because that would be Travellers.
You also wanted to know whether they've changed the ending from the book, but as you haven't read the book, and I only read the first couple of chapters...
And as I said, the ending's actually in the middle...
Yes.
Yeah, so I don't know, but even if they have, it would effectively be changing the middle.
Neil Jeffrey on Twitter went to see G-Force, in 3D with my nine-year-old.
I saw it in 2D, incidentally. Oh, and I have to say, I don't think I missed anything.
Are my skills as a film connoisseur hampered because I vaguely enjoyed it?
No, I vaguely enjoyed it as well, but it is yet more proof that the whole 3D thing is baloney and is being used as a device by Hollywood studios purely to con us all into thinking that somehow we're getting a better experience in 3D, when the actual truth of it is that all that's happening is that they are upgrading their screens at our expense, and they are doing it in order to combat piracy, which the whole industry is having conniptions about and is a complete red herring, because piracy is not the problem. The problem is distribution. The problem lies with the solution lies with the distributors. That's the beginning and end of it.
Graham, can you buy my friend Roo Smith some food? We're here at the Cropperty Festival.
Yep.
He spent all his money on getting to the festival and getting his van repaired so he can go. So
has he got a VW van? Because everybody seems to have a VW van.
And a hat.
A VW van and a hat, yes.
And some bells on their feet.
We used to have a VW van and it caught fire.
Martin Byrne says, what you have to do if you're going to Cropperty, learn the words to meet on the ledge.
Yes.
Which is a Fairport classic, of course. Actually, you won't need to, because before you leave, it'll be burned into your brain. of course, Fairport closing the festival tomorrow. It's interesting to have a three-day festival over Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Yes, I know.
Agree. Saturday, Sunday. But apparently it's so that you can recover on the Sunday, play cricket if you want to.
I think it's really good. I think it also clearly indicates that it is a festival that is catering to perhaps the older gentleman who would need a day after a night on the Scrotox Old Dirigible or, yes. Fairport 5.
As my teenager said earlier, the old people and the losers. Which is us, to a T.
Yes.
Absolutely to a T.
Did you know that there really is, around when they have festivals, they have tents around, it's knit your own hessian and, grow your own yogurt and all that sort of stuff. And at the back of this, they literally have got a renter mobility scooter tent. They really have.
Went past that.
Really.
So it's Quentin Tarantino Day. He has a new movie and, this hasn't gone very well on this program for Quentin over the years. Let's see if his fortune is about to change.
Okay, well, the first thing we have to say is that there is a new Quentin Tarantino movie out, and shall we just address the title issue? And
allowed to say it once.
Okay.
You say it, and I'll look the other way.
Okay. The misspelt title, and if you're in a car, you have kids, you don't want them to hear the title, turn the radio down for 30 seconds. The misspelt title of Quentin Tarantino's new movie is Inglourious Basterds, but spelt E-R, and Inglourious is spelt wrong, okay? As you probably know, there is already a film with that title, not spelt incorrectly, from the 1970s.
But don't say you can't say
No, I'm not going to say it again. No, Enzo Castellieri, whatever his
We've
name
used
is.
Used our quota up.
Williamson. And that, funnily enough, is a kind of... It's a sort of, action-adventure, funny, thriller, exploitation movie. The tagline of it is, whatever the dirty doesn't do, they do it dirtier. And if you're a kraut, he'll take you out. Which very much could have been the tagline for the new Tarantino movie. Now, the title issue has been a problem from the Tarantino end of it. Because if you've been watching the television recently, you will have seen all over the place, there are trailers for a movie that's apparently called Inglourious. So whereas, my stance on this is, look, if you're going to call a movie something, call it that thing and stand by it. But in fact, what they've done is they've said, oh, well, we can't use that word. And some of the posters seem to just say Inglourious as well, because there's an issue with putting that word up. So fine, Quentin, if you're not going to say it, we're not going to say it either. It is, from here on inwards, Inglourious. And I think, honestly, they should have just had the strength of their convictions. But there we go. So, the new Quentin Tarantino movie, Inglourious, which is a World War II thriller in which at least one of the plot strands concerns a crack team of elite but very scruffy sort of renegade hitmen who are being sent out to kill Nazis. Here is a clip that explains that part of the plot.
Now, I'm the direct descendant of the mountain man Jim Bridger. That means I got a little engine in me. And our battle plan will be that of an Apache resistance. We will be cruel to the Germans. And through our cruelty, they will know who we are. And they will find the evidence of our cruelty in the disemboweled, dismembered, and disfigured bodies of their brothers we leave behind us. And the German will be sickened by us. And the German will talk about us. And the German will fear us. And when the German closes their eyes at night, and they're tortured by their subconscious for the evil they have done, it will be with thoughts of us that they are tortured with. Sound good?
Yes, sir!
That's what I like to hear. But I got a word of warning for all you would-be warriors. When you join my command, you take on debit. a debit you owe me, personally. Each and every man under my command owes me 100 Nazi scalps. And I want my scalps. And all y'all will get me 100 Nazi scalps, taken from the heads of 100 dead Nazis. Or you will die trying.
That's pretty much the tone of it.
I quite like the sound of it.
I know, and I'm really trying to be balanced, and I'm going to be very balanced. So, the first thing to say is, there are things in Inglourious that remind you what a really good filmmaker Quentin Tarantino can be or has been. The interesting thing about him is this. He's somebody who's very good at set pieces. And I don't mean action set pieces, I mean dialogue set pieces. If you look back at his kind of classic work, you think of, you know, the opening of Reservoir Dogs, you think of the Let's Get Into Character scene from Pulp Fiction, you think of that moment, you know, with the story of the watch, which is just a, you know, fantastic scene. You think of speeches that are delivered almost like songs, and that kind of explains why it is that, particularly in the early years, Quentin Tarantino movies would arrive with a soundtrack album which alternated songs with speeches. I mean, the Reservoir Dogs soundtrack has got all the, you know, the super sounds of the 70s stuff in between by Steve Wright, not our Steve Wright, but by the other Steve, not our own, our very own Steve Wright, but by the other Steve Wright.
Stephen Wright.
Yes. And on Pulp Fiction, there's, you know, there's long sections in which they play dialogue sections as if they are music. And it is undoubtedly true that he has a panache and a style, both with writing and with directing, in which he can take scenes and he can put them together, and he knows where to put the camera, and he knows how to make the scene have an arc within itself that is completely coherent. And there's a very good example of this at the very beginning of Inglourious, in which
Studs,
yes, in which somebody who refers to themselves as the Jew Hunter comes into a shack, and there's a very tense conversation in which you know that there are people hiding somewhere in the shack, and you know that he might know that, but maybe he doesn't. And the whole thing is literally a kind of game of words between him and the guy who owns the shack, and it's done very well, and it's really kind of played out in a way which demonstrates that Tarantino does understand how to do this stuff, and that when he puts his mind to it, he can be, you know, he can be strangely disciplined. He's also said, you know, it's a Jewish revenge movie. That's great. It's not, obviously, not entirely original. There have been several of those before. I
mean,
Defiance was actually fairly recent, because that wasn't the first anyway. But Defiance is in recent memory. I mean, Quentin will tell you, oh, well, I've been writing this for 10 years. Therefore, anything that happened in the last 10 years doesn't count. It's done in chapters, the first chapter of which is called Once Upon a Time in Nazi-Occupied France, which I think at one point they were thinking of using as a title. And again, you go back to his early work. He's been chaptering stuff for a very long time. And in Pulp Fiction, what we see is the kind of the coming together of all that chaptering, that the strands interweave and they cross over and they work really well together. In the case of Inglourious,
Studs,
the chaptering seems to me to be the beginning of the issue, which then undermines the film. And it goes something like this. Quentin Tarantino has the ability to write and the ability to direct and the ability to construct within the basis of a scene itself something which is coherent, which has that thing that everyone refers to as an arc. However, what he doesn't have is the ability to rein himself in beyond the parameters of the chapters of his movies. And what that means is that although individual elements may be very well played, very well written, very well directed and very well structured, the movie itself is ill-disciplined to a point of wanton abandon. And it occurs to me that with Quentin Tarantino's desperate love of exploitation cinema, you know, he tells you all the time how much he loves exploitation cinema. This is why he did Grindhouse. This is why he did all this stuff. The key to great exploitation cinema, as Roger Corman always said, was you get somebody who wants to be Visconti or Fellini or, you know, Antonioni, and you get them to make Stripped to Kill 3. And, you know, you say, I don't care what you do, but the fact is there have to be three scenes in a nightclub, it has to be 89 minutes long, and you have to use this actor or actress who I have got temporarily fresh out of rehab and who is available for a day. And you make them make their... And somehow what happens is, from that, they construct great work. In the case of Tarantino, however, quite the opposite has happened. He has been surrounded increasingly by people who are fanboys, people who just, like, oh yeah, you're 20, yeah, great, it's cool, oh yeah, Quentin, yeah, okay, oh yeah, you're going to be, yeah, and what they're not doing at any point is saying, Quentin, you know, this isn't making sense, you are really ill-disciplined, what you really need is a smack around the head and to be told to get into an editing room and make the thing at 89 minutes long and look at all the work that you're referring to and the conditions under which it was made. Now, he's also said the reason he doesn't use use original scores by composers because he doesn't want a composer to have that much influence over his work, which, as David Arnold said on the program last week when he was on a discussion about music and movies, it just demonstrates that Quentin doesn't really understand how it is that relationships work either in the movie industry or, I have to say, in the real world, one suspects. I mean, I think Quentin's most profound relationship is clearly with himself. So what he's done is he's pilfered lots of bits of music from other films. I mean, there's Morricone in there. There's some stuff from old horror movies in there. There are sections of music that are taken out of his record collection and put into the film as if what you're doing is sitting in Quentin's bedroom. And he goes, oh, this is a great bit. I get a record. No, it's great. I'm just going to play this.
Anyway, Quentin sounds exactly the same as all the people who surround him.
He does. They're like this. They're like, it's cool. No, it's great. Well, it was Wickle. Yeah, and I'm going to get this. But anyway, so you're going to put this again. And he does this. And what happens, therefore, is that in the middle of this film, in which there are some very good performances, there are some very good writing, it just flowers out around itself into this great big kind of mold-like construction that means that by the time you get to the good stuff, you're going, I'm fed up. I am really fed up with watching somebody waste and squander the discipline that they ought to have. And when I came out of Inglourious I came out of it thinking, I'm cross for this reason. I'm cross because there's evidence in there that he can do so much better. Why is it that I have to watch a movie in which a central character is played by Eli Roth? And Eli Roth is kind of, again, talismanic of the problem with him. Surround yourself with people who are every bit as nerdy and fanboy as you and will tell you, oh, yeah, it's great. No, it's great. No, it's great. Yeah, you know, it's great. It's great.
Eli
Roth
sounds exactly the same as...
He did. They all said that. Yeah, they all sound exactly like that. It's what they say. Oh, cool. No, it's great. Cool. That's what they sound like when they talk.
He sounded like a normal person when he came on the program.
Who did?
Eli Roth.
Yeah, but that was before Eli Roth turned into this monster. I mean, Eli Roth, when he began, was a really interesting young guy. He directed, you know, Cabin Fever, yeah, and was, you know, talented and smart. And before he was taken under the great wing of Quentin Tarantino and told, oh, yeah, no, it's great, we can do this. And then they end up making Inglourious. So, in a way, my problem with it is worsened by the number of things in it that are good. And if you went to see it, are you going to go and see it?
Well, I'm quite tempted. Is it okay. A 15 or an 18?
Oh, it must be an 18, I think. I think it must be an 18. But I think you are over 18, Simon.
Well,
I mean, I'm not.
Sometimes I get asked,
I'm not entirely sure about that, but I think you are over 18. There's just this guy, Christoph Waltz, is really, really good. There's a very nice performance by Michael Fassbender. There's a cameo role by Mike Myers, which, again, is a classic example of things are going really well. Let's blow it by getting in somebody who's, you know, incongruously, you know, if we made, I'd like to have read, I get Mike Myers, you see the Austin, oh, I love that bit in the Austin Powers movie, he does the thing about, you know, you might not want to worry about it. It's just great, I got a record to put on underneath, and he does all that, and you keep on, just stop it, Quentin, just stop it.
I feel like that when you're doing impressions.
Yeah, but, okay, fine, right, in that case, if you feel like that when I do impressions, yeah, right, imagine how I feel when I watch Quentin Tarantino on screen doing it for 2.5 hours, when I know that somewhere in the midst of all that, there's a, you know, there's an 89-minute Roger Corman movie that I'd be perfectly happy watching. Instead, I have to sit around all this, and then afterwards, people have to, and it has to play at the Cannes Film Festival, and Quentin has to be tweaking with it and twiddling with it, and then you got the 4 pages of trivia about all the films that it's referring to, and I just think, just shut up and make a proper film like you did before. Do that thing when take all your money away. You remember that artist who had a stall in London in which he destroyed everything he had, right? You remember that? He fed everything he had through a wood chipper. This was about 4 years ago. Don't look at me like I'm making this up. There was a very famous artist. He did an exhibition. It was called Everything I Have, and he put everything he had through a wood chipper. Quentin, do that. It'll do you good.
Welcome back to the fields of Oxfordshire and Northamptonshire, the border therein. We're near Banbury. It's the Crop Ready Festival. That's what it is. And Seth Lakeman has just wandered along, and we sent him away because he turned up without a fiddle.
He said, oi, no good. Come back with an instrument. I did offer to lend him my double bass, but it would have enabled me for the first time to have been able to use that joke that taxi drivers always use. How do you get that under your chin?
Very good.
Yeah.
Do you laugh every time?
No. In fact, I used to have a little card made up which said, congratulations, you are the 100 and whatever it is person today to have made the, that's a big fiddle, how'd you get that on your chin, wish you'd played harmonica,
now,
joke.
What will happen now is that Seth will turn up about 4:1.
Yes.
And it'll be entirely my fault because I sent him away, so we won't get any words with him or anything.
You could write a very good folk song called I Sent Seth Lakeman Away.
Yeah. Wouldn't be very good, though, would it? You could set it to music, and everyone could enjoy it.
Yeah.
So we've done Quentin. People may well wish to carry on that conversation.
The thing I want to be clear—it's
an 18 certificate.
Yes, yeah, so, of course. The thing I want to be—is
that language or violence?
Well, there is both language and violence.
Is there?
Yeah, and you know, it's just Quentin Tarantino. The thing I want to be absolutely clear about is that, you know, there was a lot of people saying, "Oh, he's just going to slag it off and he doesn't like it." I mean, and it's just not the case, because there are things in it that are very fun. I refer you to that, you know, opening set piece in which you just think, "Yeah, great, he can really do this. He can really direct." And I think it is true that the directors who make me crossest, and I've considered this recently in the case of John Borman, are people who actually bother me because they can do so much better. And, you know, the issue about, you know, do I have a problem with John Borman because of X's to the Heretic? Yes, but it's also because if you make Deliverance, if you make Point Blank, if you make those films, you know, you have to be that good from then on, because you've shown that you can do it. And the most troublesome thing about Inglourious is that there are flashes in it that remind me just how excited I was by Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, and just how much when Jackie Brown came out, I thought, wow, he's really come of age. And he really hasn't.
Stuart the History Nerd in Lincoln. Dear yeah. Nicole and Papa, can I point out a huge flaw in Inglourious?
Yes, you can. One of them is that it rewrites the history of World War II, incidentally.
But every American film...
No, it really rewrites the history of World War II in that...
Can I finish the email without you interrupting the email?
Yeah, go on.
The US cannot have sent an elite team against the Germans, as all the best US combatants were in the Pacific, as both the US Navy and the US Air Force units fighting Japan took the cream of the troops after checking their IQ and abilities and so on. The US forces in Europe were undoubtedly brave, but they had no elite troops.
But can I just say, actually, in the film's defense, this is why it's not a good point, the film occupies an alternative universe in much the same way that Watchmen does. You know that thing I always said about Valkyrie, was that the problem with Valkyrie was, the problem that they managed to get around is, it's a plot to kill Hitler, right? And you know that they don't kill Hitler. And that's, so you kind of know the ending. In the same way as Apollo 13, you know they don't die. Well, can I say that those rules don't apply to Inglourious? So the rules of history do not apply.
Well, Patrick's saying Tarantino's film is just a simple piece of American historical revisionism, dangerous in the sense that ignorant Americans will take it as historical truth.
Well, if anyone watches Inglourious and thinks it has anything to do with historical truth, then more fool them. I mean, it exists in a parallel... Well, I mean, like every Tarantino film, it exists in a parallel world of his head. You know, that's where everything in his world exists, in his head.
Ben Woodham's in London. Dear Flopsy and Mopsy, although the single L in Time Traveller's Wife, which he spelt with three L's, no, four actually, is clearly a silly Americanism, T2 Judgment Day is correct according to the OED. The E is optional, and Pearl Harbor is a proper noun, so is also correct. None of this excuses Inglourious.
Harbor is a word, and that's not how you spell it.
Well, it is...
Nor is it nuclear, you know.
Or aluminum.
Aluminum. Yeah, aluminum. That's my favourite. I sell aluminum sidings. Really? That
must be great. Damien's saying, did Quentin or Woody make the movie? It's hard to tell from the Good Doctor's impression.
No, because, you know...
Look, quick, before Seth comes back with a fiddle, do something. Give us a review of something, anything.
I thought you were telling me to do something with a fiddle.
No. Seth is going to tell her with a fiddle. You ignore the fiddle.
All right, because I'm aware that Seth may be coming back. Let me bundle.
He might not, though.
Let me bundle together, because we're still on holiday time. So, several kids' releases coming out. First one is the new Eddie Murphy film, which is called Imagine That. There was apparently, according to the trivia page on IMDb, some suggestion at one point that Eddie Murphy was involved in conversations with Quentin Tarantino to be in Inglourious. And, you know, so Eddie Murphy is a big problem for me, because, again, it's a question of talent, right? Clearly he's a talented guy. On the other hand, he's done several things which have made me really, really dislike the very sight of him. Then he goes and does Dreamgirls. You kind of forgive him because he's talented and smart, he does all this stuff, and then he goes back to make those horrible movies. Now he's done Imagine That. Here's the story of Imagine That, right? It's a kids movie, okay? He is a commodities broker, you know, kind of a stock market trader. You know that scene in Trading Places in which they get him off the street and they sit him in front of a computer, and the whole point is he's a tramp and he doesn't know anything about commodities. And then they say they're showing him how the price of something is going up and they're going to buy at a certain point. And he says, no, wait. And they wait for like 10 seconds and then they buy it, and he makes an extra X million dollars. They go, it's sheer luck. And he says, no, it's not. It's because we're coming up to Christmas, and in the run-up to Christmas, pork bellies are going to seem more attractive to families. They go, oh, God, he's a smart guy. Okay, well, in this, he plays that character for the whole film. Deal is, he's a commodities trader of some description who finds out that his little girl from whom he is estranged because he's good at his job, but he's rubbish at his family stuff, has got a magic blanket called a Guga, in which she puts it over her head. She can speak to fantasy characters who, it turns out, have the skinny on stock market trading. Okay?
When she puts the blanket...
She puts the blanket over her head. She meets these princesses. They tell her which companies are going up and down.
Wow.
Exactly.
I'm going to get my security blanket back.
And so he then bonds with his daughter because he wants to know from her which securities are going up and down. But the question is it... are they actually bonding? So it's a very simple problem with the film, quite apart from the fact that it's yet another one of those films in which Eddie Murphy is just doing it for the, you know, for the money. It's a movie whose target audience is the following: 10-year-old girls interested in fairies and the stock market. Now, I would think that even by Eddie Murphy's very particular portfolio, that's a small niche. Because otherwise, the film doesn't make any sense. When Flibberty and Bliddly and Bloodly Bloodly Blom say, I think such and such a company is going up and down, they say it in a fairy tale language, and he then reinterprets it for the audience. But for me, in the audience, fine, I'm 46. What good is that going to be to anybody else? So, if you have a very precocious 10-year-old who's interested in fantasy fairies and the stock market, take them to see Imagine.
They're going to love it.
Can I very quickly, while Seth is just tuning up his... small double bass.
Yes, absolutely.
Can I tell you two other things are coming out, okay?
I think Seth should carry on. He does his thing. Very good. You carry on.
Okay, so there's this film, Band Slam, which I was kind of rather looking forward to because it
looks like a High School Musical. It's one of those, isn't it? That's what it looks like on the poster.
It does. And, of course, it has Vanessa Hudgens in it, who is from High School Musical. There's actually, funnily enough, the High School Musical cast are now basically spreading out to occupy the whole of the top 10 because you've got Vanessa Hudgens in Band Slam, and then in Aliens in the Attic, you've got Ashley Tisdale, who, if you remember, I gave my Best Supporting Actress Award to last year for her fantastic turn in High School Musical 3. Now, I should say that neither Aliens in the Attic nor indeed Band Slam are as good as High School Musical 3, which was the best of the series, and you're not listening to me because you're too busy taking photographs of a man with a violin.
I am. You carry on. I'm just taking a picture of Seth.
I'll just talk to the audience in that case. So, but... in the case of Band Slam, what you have is a movie about this awkward, misfit kid who moves towns, moves to a new school where they have a rock group competition. He ends up managing a rock group, and after that, it is basically School of Rock light. And again, invoking School of Rock is always a problem because School of Rock was really terrific, and nothing that you know that you make that's kind of looking towards School of Rock is ever going to be as good as School of Rock. That said, it was much better than I thought. I kind of rather enjoyed the fact that in the wake of School of Rock, you have to do people playing bands who vaguely look like they are actually playing their instruments, and they do look like they are actually vaguely playing their instruments. And there's a very long-awaited gag which begins with the guy writing letters on the internet to David Bowie explaining how miserable his life is. And guess who makes a cameo appearance at the end of the film?
Would it
Dave Stewart.
Be...
No, that's a joke.
I was going to say Kenneth Williams.
It would be Kenneth Williams. So anyway, so Band Slam, fine. I rather enjoyed it, and it has a slightly sort of harsher, tougher sensibility than perhaps the total froth of something like Camp Rock. So it's not Camp Rock, but it's not School of Rock. It's kind of somewhere in the middle of those two. And then you have Aliens in the Attic, which I was really looking forward to because it has Ashley Tisdale in it. But I was kind of worried at the beginning because when the credits came up, she was credited as and Ashley Tisdale. And what and Ashley Tisdale means is you're not going to get enough.
Very much of her.
Yes, you're going to get a little bit of her, a sort of widgety side plot about her.
You see, and I never quite worked that out because sometimes on the opening credits for a movie or maybe it's a television show, and it will say so-and-so as the grandfather.
Yeah, it means...
Just a little thing.
Yeah,
there.
But what it means is, you see, they're special. It means that, in a way, it means we know that they're too good for this. Or no, more importantly, it means their agent thinks they're too good for this.
Yes.
And consequently, they're not just a part of the cast. So, Aliens in the Attic, perfectly fine. Not enough Ashley Tisdale, not really enough Aliens, nothing like as much fun as it ought to have been. Band Slam, on the other hand, looked like it might be sort of, you know, yucky, was actually much better than I thought it was going to be. Imagine that, only if you have a 10-year-old child who's interested in stock market commodities and fairies.
Mel, on this email,
yes.
Pearl Harbor is a place. So the spelling isn't optional. I appreciate Mark's care about these things, being an ex-editor, but he's wrong on
no,
this
I know. I understand. I do understand that has been... But it shouldn't be spelt like that. It is a place that is spelt wrongly because it's spelt by Americans. What can't spell?
Now, look, so we got 90 seconds before we finish up here as a Public Image song gets trashed by Ed Edmondson. Anything else?
There's a thriller out called Perfect Getaway, which is a story about a couple on their honeymoon, going for their ideal honeymoon vacation to an idyllic beach. Of course, it turns out not to be the perfect honeymoon. It turns out to be the nightmare because there is apparently a killer on the loose. Now, it's nothing that you haven't seen before. It's nothing that you haven't seen done before. But it's rather well played. Timothy Oliphant's really good. I think that it's well written and directed by David Toohey, with whose work, of course, you will be familiar. He's done a lot of genre work. He made a film a long time ago that was released in America. It was called The Grand Tour, and it came out here straight on video, because I think it was an HBO thing, as Dreamscape, which was a really good science fiction time-travelling movie, which brings us right back to where we began with The Time Traveller's Wife, to say that it is possible to do time-travelling stories.
Is that the Audrey Niffenegger book? That one.
Yeah. Shall we call it Inglourious Niffeneggers?
That will work.
I think that will work, okay? So the verdict on the Quentin Tarantino Inglourious Niffeneggers is that it's not as good as it should be. The verdict on A Perfect Getaway is it's much better than it had any right to be.
Movie of the week.
Perfect Getaway.
No, really?
Yep.
Okay.
Or Time Traveller's Wife.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.